So we have an HIV continuum of care model, and Aaron George is here from State Scientist High. Aaron's program, along with Boston University, is selected to replicate the HIV continuum of care model that we're talking about, do that in other jurisdictions across the country. This thing we're talking about today is just a little slide of, but really shows how communities and jails can work together in ways that may surprise you. So we're going to call this the Santa solution, and we have no conflict except that there's this thing about intranasal naloxone, which is currently off-label, and will come up later in the conversation. So this is the Santa solution. So that's Stalin. Stalin works with Stan, and we wanted to support the families who come to visit our patients in jail. And one of the wardens, well, he wasn't a warden at the time, he later became a warden, the dad, and he said, you know, I'd like to help you give out gifts. You've been doing this work with visitors. So we'd like to, you know, provide some gifts for folks for the holidays. And you can't bring most anything into jail when you're visiting. So how do you provide gifts to the kids? So what we did was we arranged for the kids to see the holiday dressed up people, get a little picture because we're riding spells with an elf, but we also had a Santa and various Santa, big, small, wide, and so they had the picture before, and then after the visit, they had a little coupon, and we, on the way out, they got an age-appropriate gift of some token of Santa. So that came in handy, and it'll be clear in a little bit. So this is just an idea of what we're talking about in New York City jails. There's 12 facilities, 9 on Rikers Island, so people talk about Rikers, but we actually have 3 borough houses. And our average daily population continues to decline. I think we're under 10,000 now. So I think I started, it was about 13,000, and it was 10 years ago. So we're little by little, still too much. And then folks who are most likely to go home to the community within a very short period of time. And stuff about, you know, several folks stay since. But most folks eventually. We have a very short length of stay in jail. Keep that in mind, just in terms of working with jail facilities. And we do have, as we mentioned earlier, electronic health records, which makes life very much easier to manage patient care, and particularly when people are moving along between those 12 facilities. So people don't come in, go to one jail, and stay there. Unless they're women. Women will go to one jail and stay there, but they'll move along between housing areas. And continuity of care is challenging, but every 15 minutes, folks are moved among between the jail, the bus goes, and it's we never actually know whether someone's going to stay or go, or plan or just work based on really those two options. Either you stay or you'll go. If you stay, I'll see you tomorrow, we'll work on this. If you go, make sure you call Stanley and staff and see them, and then you get out. So the demographic of someone in labor, it doesn't look that much different than the national we're talking about. 7% are non-Hispanic white. So no one looks like most of us. Substance use is self-reported more than half the time, but if you get into more details about those issues, it's probably close to 70-80%. Mental illness, hepatitis, HIV, all kinds of. We have 6 patients. So because of the substance use and the opiate use in our jail, we were starting to look at overdose in the community and how we maybe work with that. And that was helping us figure out how to do that. Ross McDonald, the medical director. So we wanted to do something to give out naloxone to visitors. Any idea how we might give out naloxone to visitors? Does anybody remember the Santa solution? Figured if I could give out Christmas presents, we could figure out how to give out naloxone. Those were contraband as far as DOC was concerned. It was basically the same process, right? one with a beetle, one with some plastic toy, but either could be turned into a weapon. And so we came up with this thing. We said, will you let us do Santa? Can we do the last one? And they actually said yes. Who does and doesn't know what the last one is? Anybody not know? If you know what the last one is, would you raise your hand? Okay, so I'm going to go really quickly through this so we can get to our talk. So, naloxone is a way to reverse overdose. We use it nasal. It works really quickly. We came up with a way to train people, in under 5 minutes on how to, right? I mean, nasal really had that spiel down. And and then they got a little blue card that said there were certified overdose prevention. So you did this, right? If you're in the audience and you did this work, you just raise your hand just so you know. Janet, if you, including if you packed up the kids, because it takes a while. And so we reached out to the families, and the idea really was that, you know, folks who are overdosing cannot reverse their own overdose. And if you remember back on, Mark's talk about how many people die in the first short period of time once they release, a lot of it is about this. So we thought we could, you know, maybe 6 months, and there we go. So this is right beside the end of Three Borough House. I just want to give you an airport view, which you can see if you ever fly in or out of LaGuardia Airport, just wave. And this is the bridge to right, where you go from Queens to the island. You cross the Bronx on the way, and to your right would be the LaGuardia Airport runway. And the visitor center is to the right when you come in, which is where the city bus takes folks who are visiting. And then this is kind of the flow of how we distribute the naloxone, and props to Ann Siegler for coming up with this photo and the arrows, because a picture's worth a thousand words for this. It's a strange little process. So folks come over the bridge, they come into the visitor center and go through, if I refer to it as the wash, dry, and rinse cycle. So folks have to go through metal detectors, magnetometers. They have to leave stuff in lockers. There's security clearances to make sure that folks are clean, so that there's no security violations for when they have a visit. There's no actual visits here. So this is a central visitor center security clearance, so that folks, when they come in from the city bus, will go through this process, and then will exit on the visitor's board bus to jails, visit with their loved ones at the facility. Incarcerated person will go underground and come up into like a makeshift trailer, and the visitor will come from the bus on the outside, and they'll need to have their visit. While they're doing that, our trainers, who provided little blue cards on the inside, are setting up in this, we have like a wall and three open sides to an area with a roof, behind which there is a bathroom no one should use. And although the people who are, well, I'll show you who use the bathroom. And then between the blue arrow and the red box is where people are making a beeline for the city bus to take them home, because visiting Rikers Island is an all day affair with kids. And so I always say that the visitors are visiting their loved ones. Someone said, that sounds kind of funny, like you're going to a funeral or something. I'm like, no, I think if you're visiting someone in Rikers Island jail and you went through what you had to that day to make that happen, you loved the person you were visiting.
Yes.
No joke. So here's Thea and Estella and Ariane, who are inside doing visitor training and the overdose kit and the get your overdose kit here. This is more detail of what's in the kit, but it doesn't show all the paraphernalia that we stick in, which includes what else, materials, how to get a syringe exchange program so you can get a refill.
Instructions in English and
Spanish.
What else is in the kit? Two doses of naloxone, instructions in English and Spanish, and also a list of places in all five boroughs where they can go for a free replacement.
We've been more fast than anybody. The biggest barrier to this particular process is blue bags. The state has them on a requirement contract and they can never seem to keep it refilled. My husband found an online version that is subpar, but has made an attention between saving lives or having a blue bag. Yes, which I'm doing. The research or something like this, I don't know. So, Ross came up to me once and Zach together. We said, Ross, we'd like to try this naloxone thing, and we were thinking we'd start the pilot in February. Given what I've told you about how we do this, does anybody think there was a problem at all with starting in February? And they were a little chilly. And did use the bathroom to warm up. But it was a great success. Some of the folks from the Department of Health Bureau of Alcohol and other drugs, and as well as Alison Gansley, who is our coordinator of the Visitor Center project. So we had a summer, I had a social work student who was looking for a project, and she said, is there something that we could do with this naloxone? Because she was one of the people with the bag, is the colleague of Scott, and from Columbia School of Social Work. And so Alison Dansby had a list of all the places that people, sheets of people who had signed up for naloxone with their zip code and where they were returning to. And so Cameron wondered, are the kids getting to the places where people overdose the most? Which is, that's the question, good students. So the question is, did that happen? So from June 1st to May 30th, which was the data she had at the time, because all good students have summer to recuperate. And so she had, so we found out that we had over 2,000 trained to identify the train that got the blue cards before they went off their other visit. And then we had over 1,500 that we got to stop long enough to give them the kit before the bus left. And then found that people who got the kit resided in about a third of the time, or more than a third of the time, in the communities with the highest overdose rates. Many were going to the areas where people were going incarcerated, and some were also going to the highest areas of poverty because and so this is opioid overdose mortality, which is the darkest blue areas, and then the red dots are where the kids went. You will notice that the south end of Staten Island, can I show? Yeah. So the south end of Staten Island is very dark and a lot of overdose, but not a lot of kids went there from Rikers Island. Why? Anybody know?
Staten Island is really far from Rikers, and you won't get a lot of
So that's one possibility. Does anybody have any other ideas about it?
I'll take a prescription.
So Janet thinks that I agree with Janet. I think that the poor proportion of people who are dying from overdose in Staten Island is more likely to be from prescription drugs. That is the ones made in the USA that are taxed by the government and are not those that you get arrested for, as opposed to the other folks who were in the communities of high poverty and have the greatest concentration of folks coming home from jail. So the correlation between overdose and incarceration looks very different than the correlation between poverty and incarceration. Okay. So the folks who are having behaviors that now are medical alternative to incarceration are designed to support are not arrested if they're in communities of not high poverty and high arrest rates. Is what we think. So for the study period that Cameron looked at, you can see we have a drop off in the colder months. That says it's in a nice sauce, but when the temperature goes below freezing, nobody really wants to stop long enough to grab a kit. And then Lee's laughing because there are days where she's been out with gloves and shivering. And then as the weather gets warmer, you see that we have more uptake. And so one of the things that happened through looking at this was We had about 14 folks come up to us and tell us, as repeat visitors, that they had used the kits because they get a replacement and they had actually used them to reverse an overdose. Gave it to them, but we started wondering, well, how many people are really using kits, and what's that look like compared to what the city's doing as a whole? And so we, with our colleagues in the Bureau of Alcohol and Tobacco, so it was a real partnership. We had our own staff, so correctional health staff, work at the visitor center together with community providers who are from syringe exchange programs, and were doing this in their own communities anyway. So we think, can we help the jails with our existing funding? The answer is yes. And then the folks from the Bureau of Alcohol and other drugs who were the research into this. So we had, it was nice because the caseworkers weren't also the researchers, everybody had equal exposure to the weather. And so we enrolled 289 folks in shorter than we had planned time. There were so many people who said yes. During the training, we just asked, do you want to be part of the study? Most people said yes, but people who didn't got the same services. And so we had the first round of follow-ups, and we had about 20 people say that they had used the kit in the first month after they got it to use it to reverse overdose. So we think that's pretty extraordinary. So 7% overdose refusal in the first month. This compares very favorably with what they've seen for citywide. It's kind of everybody's excited to see what happens next. And that's the team and the blue bag. And right, so Allison and Zena, while Wendy, and I don't remember the other two research guys, what the lady's name. And the one that was also keeping track, if you can imagine doing a study. That the people that are enrolling in one place, they're going away for hours, you don't know when they're coming back, and then you have to match them with their names so they can sign off that they got the kit and put it in order. It was quite a strategic thing that you did and got really good at it. No one got it in a way because it was remarkable that she was able to figure out how to get that matched up before the bus left. So generally, we think this is a very successful thing. We'd like other folks to try it. It's very low touch, very low cost, very high yield, very life-saving. And other than, I think, the middle-class neighborhood with high rates of opiate overdoses is the prescription drugs, primarily. And it's also very fun. Well, thanks very much to everybody.
So we're going to take questions, and I want to start by asking a couple of questions. Mark, you said that public health professionals ought to reach in to do advocacy. Can you talk specifically and give recommendations specifically about what public health professionals can do to reach in?
I think I gave a couple of examples. Think about the things that you do in the community. Think about the education you do at public health centers, and most of that stuff can be translated into the real prison setting. I mentioned tobacco, heart healthy diet. What a lot of the jails and prisons have started to do. There's an opportunity, but a lot of them haven't done it. They just don't know about it. They don't understand what it means. Going in and explaining to a warden, saying, "You have this great idea. This can help save lives." There's a challenge related to that because one of the few things that inmates enjoy is food. It's something that's a creature comfort. Anything that messes with food is potentially a challenge. Has anybody, by the way, had an experience where they've tried to change the diet of individuals living in jail or prison? Or can you tell? Take the microphone. So tell us about what the challenge was and how you approached it.
So we work.
Where is this?
It's on.
I work with pregnant and postpartum and pregnant women in Georgia. So any pregnant woman who goes into the prison system, we see at some point. And we really want to, and this is pending, and something we're working with the administration to do, change the actual food that they get as part of a meal program. But at the same time, we're working with the pregnant women more than the talks with them. They get a point system for how many new fruits and vegetables they try and how many fruits and vegetables they're eating per week. And then we have a certificate of completion each time they do that that goes to their case manager and can give them some more rewards and some good vibes from parole officers and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So, did you run into any challenges when you tried to get in, when you tried to reach inside? What did they say? Oh, yeah, hurry, come tomorrow?
Do you mean reconciled with the administration initially?
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, this program was at the probably a year and a half after we started working with the administration. So at that point, we weren't getting much pushback for the things that we were doing. But yes, at first, it took a very long time for any program to be improved, and it was a lot of gentle pushing, just never falling off the radar with them. I think a lot of times administrative people might just say, they might just never answer to try to get you to stop bothering them or just to send you the next hired person up so that they'll say no. But I think some gentle pushing over time, your programs are good, and if you know what they're looking for as well, we talked about reducing costs and improving safety and reducing liability for them. I think those might help them a lot.
So let me capture three thoughts that I want to emphasize. Number one, persistence. You're a pain in the ass. Number two, you hit on something that's very important to them, which is cost. So that's a great take-home message. Find what matters to the warden and its cost. And the third thing you said, there was something else that was...
Allison, how could that your presentation in terms of the distribution at, and it just sort of followed places highest concentration of poverty, highest concentration of incarceration, how else can public health professionals use that kind of model to sort of engage the hardest hit communities around those issues?
So we, you know, there's a high concentration of folks living with HIV in the jails, and we were able to leverage the information related to communities highest hit by HIV. There's overlaps in similar ways to not only receive, but also to quadruple our Ryan White service budget. So we actually were able to negotiate with HRSA to consider our population transient and to not have to wait for the lab results that we work with self-reports because of the nature of the transient population, and also to fund not only transitional healthcare coordination on the inside, working as a physician, but also to fund the Fortune Society and other community-based organizations to facilitate transportation from the right from the door of the jail over the bridge and to community programs and ideally the doctor. And a lot of that was through showing the prevalence as well as the connection to the communities who were highest hit. When you overlap the map of people coming home from jail with the highest rate of HIV infection in the city, there's only one community that has high rates of HIV that is not the high rates of poverty and high rates of incarceration. Can anybody think of what neighborhood that is? Guy? Chelsea. And Sky gets the prize for reading the paper. So that's our community of primarily white MSM who have money but have been impacted by the virus. Everywhere else, it's consistently overlapping. And that's not just HIV. That's any disease for which you may be able to get money for HIV, diabetes, heart disease, hypertension, and asthma. It's a chronic health condition. Yeah.
Yes.
But I am a casework and a practitioner. getting the institution ready for IRB approval to have a significant struggle. But as you know, we need the research to inform the practice and creating the cycle. And so I was just wondering if you had, some recommendations for getting through the IRB struggle that helps support the work that we do. And then, my next question is really about the healthcare program. As you know, we are recently
discovered that mortality pops up, and it, from a political media standpoint, that was a dangerous thing until everybody found the same thing we did, that mortality goes up. So it wasn't a Washington phenomenon. So we're lucky that we had people who were interested, but not everybody is that lucky. So I'd say a couple of things. Number one is, use our approach, persistence can be a pain in the ass, because it can be done. The only reason not to do research in a correctional population is if that research could equally well be done in a non-correctional population. But once you can justify that it only can be done in this population, you have the appropriate safeguards in place, there is nothing in federal law that prevents you from doing it. There are some additional steps. So I serve on the IRB at the University of Washington as the prison study advocate. Because if you have a federally funded project within the IRB, there has to be a prison advocate on the IRB. And so that's one of the things that I do when we get projects and we do it. I think the third thing I would suggest is if you start to lay the groundwork with the IRB. If they're new to this concept, then you're welcome to communicate with me, and I would get in touch with our IRB in the University of Washington, if that would help IRB if they talk IRB. And set the groundwork for it. Say, what are the impediments, what are the barriers that you perceive for us to for people to bring prison-related research to you, and then start to address those barriers. But at the end of the day, the federal law, as long as you do all the things you're supposed to do, which are not onerous and more onerous than the IRB process is anyhow, it can be done. You just push and get it.
Yeah. I'd like to add to that. I'm also on the IRB at Vera Institute, in New York City. I'm the prisoner advocate on the IRB. And one of the things that I look for to make sure that the protections are there for men and women who are incarcerated, and that the study has been thought through in terms of both the risks and the benefits, and how those challenges and how those risks will be played out, and how you thought through that process. And I would also offer Vera, Jim Parsons, who is the director of research at the Vera Institute, to talk to him about it. Vera does a lot of research with prisoners. And stay persistent. It's not that IRBs don't want that to happen. IRBs, I think they take the obligation really seriously to make sure that vulnerable people are protected.
Yeah, I would love the IRB hold back. I also am not a fan, I think some social work workers, of withholding information. So when you have folks, it's trickier, but as long as you're showing that you're comparing the person to themselves or to their cohort, those kinds of things have helped. Also, you know, persistence, the dripping water thing, I think is done, making a difference. And then, you know, just be ready for the next challenge, because when the IRBs change, the chairs change, they have new rules, they have new ideas, they have new prison reps, they have different vantage points, and so that it becomes more of an art than a science on some level, but it is possible, it's very much possible. Also, when you have federal grant funding, somehow that, to do your evaluation, that also helps the IRB see that this isn't something that just the fly-by-night jail came up with on their own to damage folks.
On your second question about the health liaison, this was an enhancement to our HIV continuum of care models. We already have existing resources for discharge planning services in the jails, and we added one person. That's it. Mm-hmm. Now, if you don't have an existing jail-based program, but you do have relationships with the jails, then you have community programs that Jared speaks to Aaron Nordstrom about on next steps. But this is a, you know, an evolutionary process, right? So Jack started 20 years ago with with a CDC prevention grant and going into the jails and doing health education risk reduction. Why? Because the epidemic had started, because the jails were concerned not only about the patients but also the officers were worried about getting HIV. She preyed on their fears a little bit, got things like a common distribution policy, got access to going to housing areas. That became relationship building. So I guess the bottom line for us is remove the barriers that you can remove, establish relationships where you can, as you did, right? And then take it, you know, where you can, one step at a time.
Go.
Yeah, you know, we tried this here in the long term,
just to get enough correction to agree to do this and have an operation order. Make sure that it's part of the daily, it's like law, it's their law. They have to follow the law and this is what they do. And we had a lot of these warnings because they warned and the officers didn't want it. It was all a big mess. Even the community was fighting us and us giving karma in the jail. However, I think relationships make a big difference, right? So it's who you know, I guess. And I just have to go in there and say, look, this is what has to get done. And I need to do this, and how can you help me do this? And so what I did was I let them tell me what I could do with it. But it can't go away. It's going to happen. You just got to tell me how you want it. So that's what they did. They agreed to doing that. So I negotiated with them. So the negotiation wasn't great, but it's not bad. So more than three condoms are contraband, considered contraband. If they catch the condom open, a wrap open, you get a ticket, which could be tied within more.
It is open. Yeah.
And of course, there's no sex in jail, but they're not catching. Right. But it was better to give them, and then three condoms per person. But you could get three condoms a day through a medical model. So we could not go into the housing area and say, hey, girl, I got condoms, here you go. No, they have to come down, and we had to pull them up to the clinic, and then the staff or nurse or anybody, the doctor, whoever was in the clinic, I said, if you were in the clinic, you were able to get the free condoms.
But Jackie, who did you negotiate that with? Because I think there are certain things you don't want to negotiate with the commissioner, right? Because the commissioner will put the kibosh on it, and he puts the kibosh, it's done. Who did you negotiate with him?
I negotiated with all the deputy commissioners first. I started with them and let them work themselves up and let them agree first and also when they went to the commissioner. Then there was an agreement and then the commissioner.
And that's important, right? Because she went to the middle management because they can do operational or facility level orders that don't require commissioner sign off. So you can do it facility by facility that then became a practice of the department. So that's critical.
And she also said that the condom was not for use during jail stay because, of course, there is no sex in jail. So you need to, if you are all the jailers on the left brain side and you are all the social workers on the right hand side, the social workers have to keep to themselves, public health professionals, that you want this as a public health thing because you want to make sure that if people are having sex in jail that they're using a condom. You want to leave that part out of your conversation.
What the jailers are concerned about is not about that they want to make sure there's no sex in jail, but they are also community residents. And as community residents, they want to make sure that people who are coming out of jail have condoms so that they don't have sex with the women in their community who might be related to them when they come out without a condom. And so she preyed on their fears of HIV in that kind of a way.
And so don't ask them for condoms so that people can have sex in jail. They have to protect themselves because you're in a jail setting, and you never know if someone's going to stay or they're going to go. And so we need to make sure that in the event that they leave, that they're prepared. And that was the issue. So, and also, you know, at the negotiation table, I did say that I will give them all the officers all the condoms they want. And that I will actually address roll call at 7 o'clock in the morning, at 8 o'clock in the afternoon, and at 3 o'clock in the evening, so that I can give up comments and talk about HIV and train all the officers on HIV.
Okay.
And I feel like that.
So thank you all for participating. There are online feedback forms. Please go online, fill out those feedback forms. They will be very helpful. The workshop was 4217.0, the nexus of correctional health policies and practices. Thank you.